Welcome to The Catholic Opinion. My name is Father Anthony Sumich of the Priestly Fraternity of St. Peter, coming to you from Auckland, New Zealand. And our show concentrates on the history of the Catholic Church. And this is something we have been talking about over a long period of time. So welcome back to our regular listeners and to anybody new to the show. My name, as I said, Father Anthony Sumich of the Priestly Fraternity of St. Peter. Our apostolate here in Auckland is that of the Latin Mass apostolate, the Latin Mass chaplaincy. If you're interested in some information about that, you can find us on the web at www.fssp.nz. And our Facebook page is FSSP Auckland. That's AUCKLAND. So, as I said, we have been talking about the history of the Catholic Church and the building of Christendom. And over the last couple of years, we have worked our way through into the 11th century, a majorly turning century in church history, a large, large part of church history is focused on this period that was so devastatingly bad in the first half of the century in terms of the leadership, not only within the church, but even within European society, as feudalism had reached its peak. And this also affected the situation in the church, where a lot of feuding families were after the papacy in order to promote their own ends. To that end, as we finished last week, in the year 1053, around 1054, and this is, of course, the time of the Great Eastern Schism, and with the Pope having led an army south of Rome to try and free the people of Benevento from the Norman occupation, in which there was large-scale massacres and the people were crying for help, but none was coming from the Emperor of Europe and Germany and none was coming from Eastern Christendom. So the Pope himself led an army south and he was captured. And it was at this time that the Phocian Schism begins, or not totally begins, but at least the beginnings of it had started in Constantinople. And so the real reason behind all this was because the seat at that stage, the seat of Peter, was empty, as the Pope himself was held in prison to the south of Rome. Now, where I'd been talking about last week was this defiance that the Eastern Patriarch was showing towards letters coming from Rome telling him what he can and cannot do, and he was very defiant against these directives that he was receiving. And the problem also was that Pope Leo IX knew no Greek, and so we also had a linguistic problem going on. We have no idea how carefully his representative, Cardinal Humbert, may have reviewed with him the text of the letter which went to Michael Cellularius, but Humbert was now drafting it before Pope Leo had signed it, and we may presume that the Pope approved its essential elements and very probably much of its wording as well, as given in Latin, but the fact remains that the final form of the letter was in a language he did not know, that being Greek. If he could have written or even read it, he might have made that letter to the Easterns a little less harsh. And we've been talking about Cardinal Humbert last week, because Humbert, though a man of far nobler motivation than Michael Cellularius in Constantinople, was even more vehement and rash and headstrong than that ambitious patriarch. Humbert had much more zeal than he had judgment. And this has been shown during the discussion of the canonical status of ordinations by Simonist bishops early in Pope Leo's pontificate. Humbert had never retreated from his conviction that no priest ordained by a Simonist bishop should ever be allowed to act as a priest, whatever the cost to the church. He'd even gone so far as to deny all validity to the ordinations themselves, thereby falling unwittingly into the ancient Donatist heresy that made the validity of sacraments conditional on the personal worthiness or unworthiness of the cleric bestowing them. This, of course, was a problem early in the church. In a certain sense, he was the wrong man to be involved in these delicate negotiations between Rome and Constantinople. But Humbert appears to have been the only man at Benevento where the Pope was tied up, trusted by the Pope, who knew enough Greek to conduct these negotiations. Pope Leo's letter to Patriarch Michael Cirillarius, responding to Leo of Ochrida, drafted by Humbert, was for the most part a reasonable, if very firm, warning, but descended at some points into sheer polemic and threats. If Pope Leo specifically approved this language, it was most likely due to his growing awareness of the magnitude of the risk and of the stakes, coupled with frustration at his continued helpless imprisonment at Benevento. The Byzantine Emperor Constantine IX now intervened with a conciliatory letter received in Benevento in September, along with a surprisingly conciliatory letter from Cirillarius as well. Until the climax of this controversy, the harsh and insulting communications from Cirillarius' church were always written and signed by someone else. Though, such was the scope of his power that it's very hard to believe that he did not have a hand in them. Consequently, Pope Leo and Humbert toned down the language of their letters to the Patriarch and the Emperor before dispatching them to Constantinople. But they now decided that a papal embassy must be sent to Constantinople to discuss the problem. Inevitably, under the circumstances, the Pope chose Humbert to lead it. Its other two members were Chancellor Frederick of Lorraine and Archbishop Peter of Amalfi, both ignominiously captured at Civitate along with the Pope. The Normans permitted them and Humbert to depart from Benevento in January of 1054. During February, the embassy conferred at length with Argyros, who counseled them on how best to deal with Cirillarius and how to undermine his influence at court. In March, they took ship for Constantinople. They seem to have been so preoccupied with their mission as to pay little attention to the condition of their master and mentor. Because Pope Leo IX was dying, his body could no longer retain food. On February the 12th, when his ambassadors were conferring with Argyros, he said his last mass. He asked the Normans to let him return to Rome, saying that God wished him to die in St. Peter's, and the Normans let him go. There is no documentary evidence whatsoever that he ever yielded to them by recognizing any of their conquests as right or their rule as just. Carried on a litter, he arrived in Rome for Easter, where he asked to be taken at once to St. Peter's. He was anointed at the Vatican, and afterwards, in each of the few days that remained to him, he had himself carried into St. Peter's, where, lying beside his own coffin, in intervals of fervent prayer, he spoke to the throngs waiting and praying with him, using his condition to demonstrate the vanity of the world. He prayed for the purification of the church, for the dead of Civitate, perhaps especially for the souls of those 700 heroic Swabians who, unlike so many others he had known and trusted, had stood by him unflinching to the end. He would have prayed for the conversion of heretics and Jews and for the people of each and every one of the many lands he had visited as Pope. He absolved all that he had excommunicated. He prayed especially for the salvation of the soul of ex-Pope Benedict IX, still living and even attempting to maintain his claims to the papacy, he who had done so much harm to the church. Each day, Pope Leo would trace the sign of the cross on his coffin and proclaim, "I believe that my Redeemer liveth." On April the 19th, just after Mass and a last communion, he died. So great was the calm at the moment of his death that not a leaf moved ever so little. Then the great bell of St. Peter's began to toll, and men saw visions of angels, ever the special friends of this Pope, leading him up to heaven. He had reigned just 5 years, but through 2 millennia the Church of Christ had known no greater vicar than this tall, red-haired Bruno of Alsace, Pope St. Leo IX. Meanwhile, Humbert's embassy had landed in Constantinople and had been honourably, if rather gingerly, received by Eastern Emperor Constantine the Ninth, but for some time found nothing to say to Patriarch Michael Cellularius. We do not know exactly when the news of the Pope's death reached Constantinople, but transmission even of the most important news from Rome to the metropolis on the Golden Horn normally required about 2 months. Therefore, it was probably not known until mid-June. When the news did arrive, in all probability, it triggered the crisis. For ambassadors of a dead pope have lost their authority. And Cellularius would naturally have assumed he need no longer heed Cardinal Humbert and his party. This conclusion would have been rendered all the more welcome by the virulent pamphlet war in which Humbert had enlisted his smoking pen almost from the moment of his arrival. He had answered an equally intemperate attack by the Sudite monk Nicholas Stetatus by calling him a pestiferous pimp and a disciple of the malignant Muhammad. Under the emperor's pressure, Nicholas retracted and apologized. But Pope St. Leo IX, having gone to heaven with no successor as yet, there remained no power on earth that could make Humbert retract and apologize. On Saturday afternoon, June 16, 1054, 2 months after the Pope had died, in one of the most melancholy scenes in the history of Christendom, Cardinal Humbert, despite having lost his authority and because of having lost his judgment, with the other ambassadors trailing behind him, came striding in full regalia up the central aisle of the Church of the Holy Wisdom, Santa Sophia, the largest in Christendom, to slap upon its main altar a notice of excommunication of Patriarch Michael Cellularius. This document was not a papal bull, despite hundreds of repetitions of that era by unthinking historians. For bulls can only be signed by popes, and Pope St. Leo IX had never signed, nor in all probability ever would have signed, such a document as this of Humbert's, listing every charge which might possibly have been made against the Byzantine Church and liturgy, whether or not they had any connection with Michael Cellularius, and with a reckless disregard for their degree of truth, though the fact remains that about half of them were true. Ceremonially shaking the dust of Santa Sophia from their feet, the angry procession withdrew, undoubtedly to the great, though silent, satisfaction of Michael Cellularius, who had surely hoped from the beginning for some such result from his provocation. The distraught Emperor Constantine IX, taken completely by surprise, sought a conciliatory meeting, but Humbert and Cellularius were no longer on speaking terms. Cellularius wanted to expose the embassy to a furious mob that might have killed them, but the emperor saved their lives and sent them away unharmed. Cellularius burned their notice of excommunication in a riotous public ceremony and matched it by a similar notice of his own against them. At that time, the schism involved only the Byzantine Church as led by Michael Cellularius. Humbert did not return to Rome immediately, but went first to Russia, where the able and devout King Yaroslav the Wise, son of St. Vladimir, may still have been reigning in Kiev. It's not known whether Humbert sought simply to prevent Russia from joining the schism or to try to persuade the Russian church to join in his condemnation of Cellularius. In fact, the Russian church continued to use the Slavonic liturgy, though agreeing to accept Greek bishops in Kiev, and did not at this time break with either Rome or Constantinople. As for Michael Cellularius, he lasted only 4 more years, until the able general Isaac Comnenus became emperor and refused to be dominated by him, as Constantine IX had been. Late in 1058, Cellularius was arrested and imprisoned, among other reasons for having worn imperial purple leggings. He died on his way to the church trial he demanded rather than resign his office. But his defiance of the Westerners had been popular, for many in Constantinople resented them, So Isaac Komnenos felt obliged to give him a sumptuous ceremonial burial in the capital city. No serious attempt was made on either side to heal the breach until after the great military disaster inflicted by the Muslims on the Byzantines at Manzikert in 1071. By then, the wounds of 1054 had had 17 years to fester. It was too long, and there was too much hostile history behind them. Reunion, though periodically attempted all through the centuries of the glory of Christendom in the High Middle Ages, was never attained. It remains unattained today, though in 1966 Pope Paul VI and Patriarch Athenagoras of Constantinople at long last jointly annulled the reciprocal excommunications of Humbert and Michael Charularius in 1054, however invalid they may have been. In the last days of Leo IX's pontificate, his trusted Cardinal Hildebrand was representing him in France at a synod meeting at Tours, where Berengar finally abjured his Eucharistic heresy, but apparently insincerely, for he returned to it as soon as he felt safe in doing so. Leo had particularly emphasized church reform and renewal in France, probably because the French-speaking regions had been the origin of the principal reforming movements of the time. Above all that stemming from the monastery of Cluny, and also those from Brun in Belgium and Fécamp and Bec in Normandy. King Henry I of France had not been a particularly dutiful son of the church. Only the year before, in 1053, he had defied Pope Leo over the appointment of the Bishop of Le Puy, demanding his own nominee in preference to the Pope's. But in February 1054, Henry I had suffered a major defeat at the hands of young Duke William of Normandy at Montemer. The French Normans were almost as skilled and resolute in war as their descendants in Italy. After the verdict of Montemer was confirmed 3 years later by another Norman victory at Varaville, Normandy was for all practical purposes independent of the French crown. Pope Leo, victimized by the Normans in southern Italy and unable to reach them by any Christian appeal, had somewhat more success with the Normans of North France. His decisive action was to depose Montgeres, a worldly-minded member of the ruling ducal family of Normandy, as Archbishop of Rouen, the Norman capital, and to replace him by Marilius, a holy ascetic monk of Fécamp Monastery, the leading centre of monastic reform and Catholic education in Normandy. As its chief prelate, Marilius did much to inspire and guide the large-scale Catholic renewal then taking place in Normandy, which saw the number of its religious houses triple from between 1035 and 1066. The same currents were flowing in the rest of France. In 1055, at a council probably held at Lyon, Hildebrand brought about the deposition of seven Simonist bishops, among them Hugo of Embrun, who found himself unable to deny his guilt when face to face with Hildebrand. Despite his strong belief that the Roman Church should, as of old, continue to play an essential part in the selection of popes, St. Leo IX had not formally changed the procedure whereby the emperor nominated the pope. That procedure was therefore followed once again after Leo's death. Henry III nominated his chief counsellor, Bishop Gebhard of Eichstätt. The Roman Church seems to have accepted him with enthusiasm. He took the name Victor II and was consecrated in April 1055 after voicing his commitment with these significant words, quote, "My whole self, body and soul, I devote to St. Peter, and though I know myself unworthy of the holiness of such a seat, yet I obey your command, but on this condition, that you render to St. Peter those things which rightfully are his." Unquote. Emperor Henry III and the new Pope were both present at a synod convened in Florence on Pentecost Sunday 1055, which reaffirmed Leo IX's unsparing decrees against simony and clerical unchastity, and deposed several more bishops for breaking them. Also at this synod, Henry III presented a formal complaint to the Pope regarding use of the imperial title by King Ferdinand I of Castile and Leon, son of Sancho el Mayor. Ferdinand was now the undisputed leader of Christian Spain and had called a council at Cuenca for the restoration of Christendom. Pope Victor II ordered Ferdinand, on pain of excommunication, to stop using the title which only one man in Christendom, that of Henry III, now rightly bore. Clearly recognizing the Pope's authority to give such an order, Ferdinand promptly obeyed it, while declaring that nevertheless he did not regard himself as in any way politically subject to Henry III. The great Holy Roman Emperor had reached his apogee, and in September of 1056, Pope Victor II was finally able to persuade him to intervene with full force against the riotously triumphant Normans of South Italy. But within a month of making this decision, Henry III, just 39 years old and in excellent health throughout his life, died suddenly and totally unexpectedly after a short illness. He left a six-year-old son, Henry IV, and his wife Agnes, whose true vocation seems to have been the religious life rather than handling great affairs and public life. Pope Victor II worked with skill and devotion for the boy emperor and his uncertain regent mother, obtaining the support first of the reformed Duke Godfrey of Lorraine and the bellicose Count Baldwin of Flanders, and then of the German princes assembled at Regensburg for Christmas in 1056. There was no rebellion, though in the past this had been almost automatic in Germany after an emperor's death, even when there was a strong adult successor. Pope Victor II returned to Italy in February 1057, making determined and largely successful efforts to establish peace there, except, of course, among the Normans, whom even Robert Guiscard could not now control. He was preparing to go for the first time to France when, like Henry III, he suddenly died after an illness of less than a week in 1057. The church leaders and people of Rome acted quickly to choose a new pope. There seems to have been little or no expectation that a nomination would come from Empress Mother Agnes or anyone at the German court authorized to speak for her in this matter. The clergy of Rome had already become a very different body from the turbulent tools of aristocratic factions who had done so much to disgrace the papacy early in the century. By and large, the Roman clergy now reflected the resolute, serene commitment of Pope St. Leo IX to a reformed church. The people of Rome may well have shared this commitment of their clergy more than most historians are now willing to recognize. The laity in Milan carried on a fight for reform against a still corrupt clergy for the next 14 years, and they certainly wanted a continuation of the good order and just administration they had known since the advent of Leo IX. Within just 5 days, the clergy and people of Rome had proclaimed as Pope Cardinal Frederick of Lorraine, a brother of Duke Godfrey, who had been a close confidant of Leo IX. He had been captured with him at Civitate and had accompanied Humbert to Constantinople, and had been appointed abbot of Monte Cassino by Victor II. He took the name of Stephen in the numerical reckoning here used, Pope Stephen X. His pontificate lasted less than 8 months. During this short span, he had time to do little more than confirm his unqualified support of Leo IX's reforms by endorsing the lay reformers in Milan and ordering the reluctant St. Peter Damian to accept the See of Ostia. He sent Hildebrand to Germany for the Christmas gathering of the leaders of that realm at Goslar to gain the full recognition as Pope which he had not sought from them at the time of his election. Hildebrand persuaded the pious Agnes, apparently without much difficulty, to extend the recognition. But Hildebrand was still in Germany when Pope Stephen X fell mortally ill. He ordered the Roman clergy, on pain of excommunication, not to elect his successor until Hildebrand should return from Germany. Then on March 29, 1058, he died in the arms of St. Hugh, abbot of Cluny. Once again, it must be recalled that each pope is sovereign and equal in his sovereignty to every other pope. Therefore, each pope has full power to change at will any preceding canon law, practice, or procedure in the church, including those involving the election of his successor. Until his successor is elected, according to the previous pope's prescriptions, no one else has authority to change them. Pope Stephen X's order requiring the presence of Hildebrand for a valid papal election was therefore absolutely binding. Indeed, he could even have made Hildebrand the sole elector for the next pope. It rendered wholly null and void the almost immediate proclamation by an alliance of Tusculan and Crescentian nobles of Bishop John Mincio of Velletri as Pope Benedict X, since Hildebrand was still in Germany when this was done. Traditionally, popes were consecrated by the Bishop of Ostia. St. Peter Damian was now Bishop of Ostia. He refused absolutely to consecrate the antipope, so one of his clergy was induced or compelled to do so. The intrigue grows. Apparently, very soon after news of these events came to the German court, Hildebrand was able to take advantage of his presence there and his already established influence with Emperor Mother Agnes to secure rejection of the antipope, who in any case had no significant support in Germany, and a willingness to support his nominee, who was favoured by the church reformers in Italy, Bishop Gerard of Florence. Hildebrand and Agnes agreed also in charging the redoubtable Duke Godfrey of Lorraine with the task of guarding Bishop Gerard in Italy. The leading churchmen of Rome met in Siena in December under Duke Godfrey's protection, with Hildebrand present, and elected Bishop Gerard Pope. He took the name of Nicholas II. Duke Godfrey marched on Rome, where a strong party favoured the legitimate pope and opened the city gates to him. On January 24, 1059, Pope Nicholas II was consecrated and enthroned at St. Peter's. But the anti-pope had escaped and was maintaining his pretensions. Duke Godfrey had retired to Tuscany, the challenge of the Roman nobility, attempting once again to control a papal election, had shown how precarious politically and militarily was the independence even of the renewed papacy stemming from Pope Leo, St. Leo IX. And so long as the only real political and military counterweight to these nobles was the Holy Roman Emperor of the German nation, in view of past history and experience, he could well prove a very dangerous protector. Not all Holy Roman Emperors could be expected to be so good and faithful and forthright as the late Henry III. And even he had been excessively heavy-handed at times. Hildebrand in particular had not forgotten the overwhelming pressure to resign which Henry III had exerted at Sutri in 1046 on Pope Gregory VI, whom Hildebrand had so faithfully served. Henry IV would soon grow up, and then it would be unlikely that his timid mother would retain much influence over him, at least in political and ecclesiastical matters. Now, when Henry IV was still a child and the Roman nobility had just suffered a sharp defeat, was the moment for a decisive new initiative to secure independence for the new papacy. His astute political sense, blending with his total devotion to the Holy See and the charity of a saint he was to become, Hildebrand saw the answer in a flash of brilliant insight. It was as simple as this: forgive the Normans. And so with that idea hanging in the air, we shall call time on our history for today's talk. And we will hopefully have you all with us again next week as we continue on this part of the history of the church. But we will conclude today's show with a prayer. So in the name of the Father, and of the Son, and the Holy Ghost, amen. Glory be to the Father, and to the Son, and to the Holy Spirit, as it was in the beginning, is now, and ever shall be, world without end, amen. So for any of you wanting some information about our apostolate here in Auckland, New Zealand, you can find that information on our webpage, www.fsp.nz. And our Facebook page is FSSP Auckland. And my name is Father Anthony Sumich of the Priestly Fraternity of St. Peter, wishing you all a happy and holy weekend. And tomorrow, a great feast of the Exaltation of the Holy Cross. So as we work our way through this Pentecost season, we hope that you are keeping up your rosaries for our apostolate here in New Zealand. God bless you all.